Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The woman we're about to interview has had one extraordinary life, and she's a beautiful writer. Cottie Martin is an award-winning former NPR and ABC News correspondent. She's the author of 7 books, and the most recent is Paris, A Love Story. She was married to Peter Jennings and later to Richard Holbrooke, and much of the book is about her great love affair with Richard, her grief at his death in 2010 in the city of Paris, where Cottie spent perhaps the happiest time of her life with each of the men. She spent her early years in Budapest, where her parents were imprisoned by the secret police. That story is also fascinating. Her journalism career is distinguished. Early on, she was assigned to cover the troubles in Northern Ireland, and I would like to talk to her about that. Other books include The Great Escape, 9 Jews Who Fled Hitler and Changed the World, Enemies of the People, My Family's Journey to America, Hidden Power, Presidential Marriages That Shaped Our History. We spent much of the last hour talking about the DNC convention and Michelle Obama. Last hour, we'll ask her to talk a little bit about the first ladies who helped shape our history, because she's interviewed all of them and has lots of stories to tell. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Cottie. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Cottie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's just such a pleasure for me. You know, my roots are in public radio.
I know.
My first job was with NPR, and that launched my brilliant career.
Great. I'm glad to hear that it did something for you. That's good. You've had such a life. It's just, and you are a beautiful writer, too. And the book is really doing well. What is it, you say, that this one has gone to the bestseller list
after
fairly rapidly?
Yeah,
why do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, to hit the New York Times list is... The last time that happened to me was with The Presidential Marriages, Hidden Power. And it took weeks of slogging around the country to get there, and here it's a week. You know what? What I'm discovering, people are kind of hungry for authentic, unmassaged, unspun emotions. And this is a very honest account. I hope you agree with me.
Yes, very honest.
I try to be as honest about myself as I am about Richard Holbrooke, my beloved husband, and Peter, and you know, all three of us had our flaws, but the point is that we're all made of the same human material, all of us. You know, these Peter and Richard were both public men of great stature. Richard Holbrooke was a historic figure, but we all face the same challenges, the same family issues, professional issues, just you know, in different fields. And I guess I humanize people who are not normally seen in their full human light, but respectfully too. I mean, Peter is the father of my children, and so I was very mindful of that. I've never written about, you know, the 15 years that Peter and I were married, partly because obviously I respect my children, our children's privacy, but they were my first readers of Paris, A Love Story. And I said, kids, you know, anything you don't like about how your dad comes across, speak up. And they said, no, Mom, that's Dad.
And you do write about it very honestly. You also, let's start with your career as a foreign correspondent. I think that's something that many journalists, when they're starting out, say, I want to be a foreign correspondent. And you're this young woman. And it's interesting because you have this great love going on with Peter, and also this introduction to troubles in Northern Ireland and what's going on. Your bureau chief in Bonn, Germany. You've got what's going on with East Germany and West Germany, and you're being called at 3 a.m. to go to the Middle East to cover stories. You had a lot on your plate in those days.
Sure.
Plus, you were a woman in the field, where it was not, at times, it was not easy being a woman in the field,
no.
Was it?
For a while, I was ABC's only woman bureau chief. I was bureau chief in Germany. And it was a very sexist environment, you know, the news biz. I write about some pretty outrageous instances of sexual harassment that I experienced actually in local TV when I was a Philadelphia reporter and won my first major prize, which was a Peabody Award, which, as you know, is a pretty big deal. I was, I think, 23 at the time. I'd produced a documentary on China, and get this, you know, our younger listeners will have a hard time understanding this, as my daughter does, that there, the term sexual harassment had not yet been coined, and therefore, when my boss accompanied me to New York for this greatest moment in my life till to date, to receive this national award, he took it for granted that on the way back to the train for Philly, he could make a move on
me. Can you believe that?
And that no one would be the wiser. And of course, I describe in the book what happened, and I put him to sleep by telling stories.
He had the audacity to book hotel rooms for you.
That's what it was in the late 70s. You know, it was a pretty tough world out there. But never mind. We press on. I mean, if this book has a theme, it's survival, mm-hmm. and it's about the fact that, you know, none of us gets off scot-free. You know, life is just so full of unexpected challenges, and it's how you deal with them that mark who you are, because it's so easy to say, oh, hell, I give up. I'll just have kids and stay home and bake cookies, as one of our great...
Exactly.
Yeah, ladies, first ladies said. But I never did do that. And on the other hand, Kathleen, I wanted a full life, which means having kids and having a family, at least for me. I mean, that was my private choice. I always wanted a family. And so Peter and I did create a wonderful family, a boy and a girl. And we had this great, passionate, tempestuous love affair. But Peter was an old-fashioned guy. And once, although when we courted and married, I was a foreign correspondent, we met in the field, and I describe some of our crazy adventures, mostly in Paris, which is at the heart of this book. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but Paris somehow is where every good thing has happened to me, including Peter. So I wasn't hiding my ambition from Peter throughout our courtship, but somehow he expected that once we married and bought a house and, you know, had kids, that ambition would kind of be supplanted by the other task, which he considered more important, which is looking after him full-time and our children secondarily.
Isn't that strange? Because he must have been attracted to this vital reporter in the field who knew how to write and was in harm's way at times. That's what initially must have attracted him, not baking cookies in an apartment somewhere.
Which I hardly do with distinction. That's what I thought, but probably that's what he thought too, but then once I became Mrs. Jennings, it became obvious to me that we couldn't have two people in this family chasing stories. So that's when the survivor in me once again leapt to the fore, and I figured out that I could write. Because until then, I'd never written anything longer than a radio or TV script of 1 minute's duration or 2 minutes. And so I discovered that if I could have my writing published, then maybe I could make a living as a writer, because there was no question that I would need something to nourish the mind. And so I wrote a story which I sent off just blind to Atlantic Monthly.
And about the Pope, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was that earlier?
No. Yes, the Pope was... Boy, you are a good, careful reader. Wow, such a pleasure to talk to you. Yes, I wrote a story about John Paul II, the Polish Pope, and I wrote it while I was nursing Lizzie at home on maternity leave, and lo and behold, Atlantic made it its cover. And so I thought, wow, I can do this.
Wow.
It was amazing. And plus to see my name on the cover of Atlantic, you know, on newsstands. We were living in London at the time, but even so, Atlantic. And so it gave me a feeling that the news business didn't. A kind of a sense of the permanence of the thing, you know, something that you could hold on to, which I didn't get from broadcast news. And so, you know, in retrospect, Peter did me a favor.
Mm. And the second article that you wrote became a book.
Yes, and changed my life. That was the first story published, I think, the first long story about Raoul Wallenberg, who was this remarkable young Swede who rescued thousands of Hungarian Jews in the last days of World War II, and then was abducted by the Russians, by the Red Army that had invaded Hungary, which happens to be my homeland, and just vanished in the Gulag archipelago. And at that point, I didn't know very much about my own history, except that my parents had been arrested and convicted as spies when I was 6 years old, living in Budapest, and then I didn't see them for 2 years. But they never talked about the prior nightmare, which was the really brutal Hungarian Holocaust. Mm. And now I started researching that. Really a light went off when I saw a one-paragraph item about Wallenberg in the London Times, saying that Wallenberg was possibly still alive. He was reported to have a sighting in a prison courtyard. And I called my father, who's living in Washington, my father also a journalist, and I said, "Papa, tell me everything you remember about Wallenberg," because my parents had been in Budapest during the same period. And my father put me on to people who worked with Wallenberg, and I subsequently traveled to 8 countries interviewing people who'd been rescued by Wallenberg. And in the course of one of these interviews, a lady who'd been saved by him said very matter-of-factly, "Well, Kati, you know, Wallenberg arrived too late to save your grandparents."
Oh, my gosh.
And that's how I discovered, I'd been raised as a Roman Catholic, and that's how I discovered that my grandparents had perished in Auschwitz.
Have you spoken to Madeleine Albright about it?
Oh,
I can
sure.
see the two of you
yeah.
having yes. long conversations about all
yes.
this.
Yes. In fact, I wrote a piece for Newsweek when she made her discoveries, because everybody was attacking her for, "Oh, come on, how could she not know that she was Jewish? She'd been back to Prague, you know, dozens of times." And in fact, I did discover my roots on my very first trip back to Budapest.
My. And so how you find out this extraordinary thing about your parents. I mean, to have your grandparents die at Auschwitz is really a traumatic thing
deal.
To hear. It's a
yeah.
very big deal.
So what do I
do? What do you do with that information?
As a writer, you turn it into a book.
Uh-huh.
And that was my first book. And that's what I mean, that it changed my life, because that's when I decided that this is what I'm meant to do, is to, and this is my eighth book now. Paris is my eighth book since then. So far, so good.
Hmm. Does it help? It seems to me you have this amazing worldliness about you. It would seem to me as though you, to be a foreign correspondent, to be able to write all of this, the fact that you are from Hungary, the fact that you have this extraordinary past with your grandparents, that your parents were journalists, that you've lived in Paris, that you lived in Germany, etc., in the Middle East, that you have a sense, you have a bigger sense of the world than most people do, and perhaps than most journalists do?
Well, I will say that after 17 years with Richard Holbrook, I certainly have
right.
You know, which really meant being on the front line of history, as opposed to covering it, which is a different thing altogether. You know, as a reporter, I was, you know, my nose pressed against the window of events, and with Richard, I was inside, and saw how challenging it is to be a policymaker as opposed to someone who just comments on policymakers. And, you know, Richard became well known to the world when he negotiated the peace that ended the most atrocious war since World War II in Europe, the Bosnian conflict. And I was lucky enough to be with him in Dayton, Ohio, when he negotiated that. And you know, those were some of the most exciting days of my life, being behind the barbed wire of Wright-Patterson Air Base, where Richard had convened this peace talk, and some of the worst criminals in European history were gathered there, the warlords who had started this war, which my husband ended. It was a remarkable feat of diplomacy, and I feel so lucky that I was there.
And he put you occasionally in places where you had to accomplish feats of diplomacy as well.
Yes, Richard was unabashed about using any tools available, including his wife. And so on the first night of the peace talks, he seated me between really two of the nastiest criminals ever want to meet.
Oh.
Slobodan Milosevic, the Serbian warlord who really sparked this bloody war, and Alija Izetbegović, the head of the Bosnian Muslims. And Richard said, "Okay, Kati, your job is to make them talk to each other." And of course, these guys had been gouging each other's eyes out a week before, and so for much of that dinner, they weren't even looking in each other's direction. And then, kind of in despair, I said to both of them, "So how did this war start anyway?" And they both kind of shrugged, and Izetbegović said, "We never expected it to be this long." And Milosevic said, "Nor this bloody." And then they started arguing back and forth about who it was who actually was responsible. And by the end of that dinner, they were calling each other Slobodan and Alija. So
because,
of course, they'd known each other their whole lives as Yugoslavs, you know, under Tito. And so I got a pat on the back from my husband for that.
Oh, you should have. A few roses and maybe a nice dinner out somewhere.
Yeah.
I can't believe he did that.
Not in Dayton.
Yeah. You start the book with, and it's one of those poignant moments of the time right before he died.
Yes.
He's in Paris.
It's our last meeting in Paris.
Very short time together, and it's this really intense time because of the nature of what he's doing. He's all over the world.
Well, he's got Afghanistan and Pakistan as his last mission, and of course that was the toughest of all. And but, you know, President Obama gave Richard his most challenging brief, and that was to get some kind of solution there. And Richard was unfortunately unable to bring the same magic to bear that he had in the Balkans. But I am told that the things that are working there, Richard had much to do with planting. But at any rate, the story, which is in Paris, as much of this book is. It's our last meeting there just weeks before his death, and he's come in, he's flown all night from Kabul just to spend one night with me. And I'm there for the book launch of the French edition of Enemies of the People, my last book. And we're having dinner with the American ambassador, who's hosting my book party, which is the only reason that we're having dinner with him, because otherwise it's our only evening and we're both, you know, kind of eager to have a little time alone.
Right.
And the phone just never stops ringing. And I get very annoyed with Richard and tell him so. So this is what I mean, Kathleen, that this is a very honest book. I don't spare myself. Here I'm in the middle of a man who's trying to stop a war, and I'm telling him, if you take that next call, I'm out of here. You know, I mean,
right.
A wife,
yeah.
A human being. And so Richard turns off his phone, and you know, I got his attention. And the next morning, we go on our last little excursion in Paris. He insists that he's going to buy me a new outfit for the party that night, and then he takes off for a conference that he's called on Afghanistan in Brussels, and that was the end of our Parisian love story.
And and he was gone,
yeah.
And nobody, you didn't know it. You talked to somebody who had been with him the night before, I believe, and he was just fine and had long conversations about the world, and then he was gone.
It was amazing. You know, all the years that I was married to Richard, I always worried when he was in the battlefield,
right,
whether in Sarajevo, where he lost three of his guys, or obviously in Pakistan or Afghanistan. But he died in Hillary Clinton's office, really. I mean, that's where he collapsed. They were in a conversation, and suddenly Hillary said, "Richard, you don't look so good." Mm. And Richard typically said, "Wait, I'm not finished," because he was giving her a full briefing on what was going on in Afghanistan. And she jumped up and said, "This meeting is over, Richard." And Richard got up. And then collapsed. And he called me from the ambulance and said he was heading for the emergency room at Ronald at GW University Hospital. And he said, "I feel a pain I've never felt." Mm. And I said, "I was in New York. Actually, I was in my gym." And I said, "I'm on my way," and those were my last words to him. And I ran to the airport in my gym clothes, and he fought for 3 days, but they couldn't repair his. It was a dissected aorta, so it was a very quick death. And you know, he died doing what he loved.
Let's pause for a moment, and we'll welcome phone calls. Cuddy Martin is our guest this hour. She's written a beautiful book about Richard Holbrooke. It's amazing, the outpouring of love, too, which we'll talk about, the phone calls she received and the weeping and how you weave your life back together after you've lost something like that. We'll talk about that. The book is about Paris. She is two loves of her life, Peter Jennings and Richard Holbrooke, and her family, her children, and it's about her parents. It's about her career as a correspondent herself for ABC and for NPR. It's just a rich read. It's good.
Thank you.
So, and we can welcome phone calls, too. I don't know if you want to call us or not. I hope some of you have read the book. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We also want to tell you that Cuddy is going to be speaking tonight. This would be a fun thing to go to tonight, have a cup of coffee and listen to her talk and then get the book. And she'll be speaking at Boswell Books, our favorite bookstore in Milwaukee, on Downer Avenue, Milwaukee, 7 o'clock tonight. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Please feel free to join our conversation. Cuddy Martin is our guest. Her book is Paris, A Love Story. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The phone calls that you received were extraordinary after Richard's death, and how loved he was by so many people. People were weeping.
Yeah. one strange call among the many was from President Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, while I was attending mass. I jumped out of my seat to take his call. And of course, Karzai and Richard were not exactly close buddies. I mean, Richard was very tough on the man, as he should have been. But, you know, Karzai said, "We need him back." And this was while Richard was still fighting for his life. And in the middle of that call, I was beeped by the State Department saying that the president of Pakistan.
Oh, my gosh.
So I thought, do these guys synchronize their calls? And that was quite a different sort of call because it was from a man who knew what I was going through, because his wife, Benazir Bhutto, this is President Zardari, the widower of Benazir Bhutto, who'd been assassinated, of course. And so he knew something about losing a well-loved spouse. And so it was a very personal call, but with both of us crying. And then subsequently he flew to Washington for Richard's memorial and came to my hotel room and gave me some really very human advice about how to deal with grief. I got a lot of that, a lot of advice on how to deal with grief, even from the great Joan Didion, who, of course, has chronicled her own passage in The Year of Magical Thinking, and then another book, Blue Nights, I think it was called. She wrote me a very touching note saying, "Dear Kati, this morning I woke up and I thought about you and all the mornings that you will wake up without Richard." And I thought, I mean, that's a very sweet note from Joan, but I do not want to wake up every morning for the rest of my life and be sad. So I have to figure out some way to work my way through this. And that's really what this book is about. This is not, Kathleen, a book about grief. There are plenty of those. This is really about as corny as it sounds, embracing life mm-hmm. after grief, because, you know, we all of us of any age, and I'm not yet old enough to be a widow, and Richard wasn't old enough to die, but we live our lives as though we had days to burn, as though, you know, the best is still to come. And what I have learned and what I try to convey in this book is that we really have to live in the present as though there is nothing beyond this moment, this moment in this studio, talking to a super intelligent woman, as I am now lucky enough to be doing, being in this beautiful city of Milwaukee for the first time in my life. And who knows if
Welcome.
I'll get asked back.
Oh, I think you will.
But this is it.
Right.
You know, I'm not dreaming of my next trip to Paris. When, you know what? I probably will at some point today dream about Paris, but I'm going to stop myself. I'm going to say, "Whoa, girl! You know what are the? You know, how do you know that you'll be back here again? So just look around you, and connect with the people that you're with, and stop daydreaming about other lives to come." And that's really what I'm trying to convey. That, you know, and it's ironic that loss. And I was dealt one of the most powerful losses
yes.
a human can be, the loss of a beloved spouse in without any warning. But loss can enhance your life. That's the message.
Yeah. You also said, tell me, we're going to go to phone calls in a moment, but I wanted you to talk more about this. After 17 years with Richard, I think I know how to get the best from myself. That was his most generous gift. Mm-hmm. I love that sentence.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, it's because, you know, he was the world's most self-confident human being, and therefore, unlike Peter, I have to say, who was the opposite.
Insecure, you say, yes.
Very insecure. And insecure people do not bring out the best in you. But secure people do. And for as far as Richard was concerned, there was nothing I couldn't do. I mean, he would just say, "Go for it. Of course you can run this organization. Of course you can write that book while, you know, your kids are having their issues, blah, blah, blah." He instilled a whole lot of self-confidence in me that I didn't have before, and which a lot of us women, baby boomers that we are, now in our 50s and 60s, you know, we didn't have strong male mentors. And I guess Richard was my first. And he really, I know that he would want me to be living fully now and not curled in the fetal position. And of course there are mornings when I do feel like, you know, staying in bed and just crying. But I don't.
Let's go to a phone call here. Put your phones on.
All right.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Kati Martin is our guest, and her book is Paris, A Love Story. A reminder, she'll be speaking tonight at Boswell Books on Donner Avenue in Milwaukee at 7 o'clock, and it should be a lovely evening. Phyllis in Brookfield, hi. Whoops. Phyllis, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello. This
Hi.
Is Phyllis.
Hi,
yes.
Phyllis.
And welcome to Milwaukee, my dear. I love
Thank
the
you.
Thoughts that you've expressed today. I am a widow as well.
Oh,
and
Phyllis.
I live with the theme song of death gives us a heartache no one can heal, but
right.
but
it's so true.
But love leaves memories no one can steal. And I think that you've coped with that as well as I have. But I wanted to ask you personally how you've coped with the adjustment of your Catholicism to your Jewish heritage.
Ah, well, that's a big subject. You know, I made the discovery of my Jewish heritage when I was 30 years old, and too late to get religion. And actually, by then, my Catholicism had sort of lapsed as well. My Catholicism was really important to me when I was a little kid in Hungary when my parents were in prison, and my godmother taught me a prayer. Because this was the Cold War. There were lots of political prisoners and lots of little kids without their parents. Anyway, I used to mumble this prayer to Mary that was guaranteed to free political prisoners. And when my parents were freed, I told them, well, guess who is responsible for your freeing? It's me. It was all those mumbled prayers.
Oh, Padre, that's a great story.
but a long-winded answer to your question that I am very proud of my historic heritage and proud of the grandparents I never knew who died such horrible deaths and bravely, I'm told. But I'm not I'm not a practicing anything. I try to practice being a good human being.
That's a big religion. We could use more of that. I want to hear, going to a totally lighter topic, but I want to hear about some of these dinner parties. I don't do them very often, but I like to mix up dinner parties as well. And I understand that you had these really unexpected combinations, and I'll bet you have some wonderful stories to tell about people you sat with each other and who was at the table and what was discussed. They sound like they were terrific.
They were amazing. This was when Richard was the American ambassador to the United Nations, and with that post comes a fabulous apartment in the Waldorf.
Woo!
And you know, I think back on those years. And it's like, wow, is that really me? I mean, it was such a different life. And the most thrilling house guest we ever had was Nelson Mandela, who stayed with us a couple of times. And we had movie stars love Mandela. Of course, everybody loves Mandela. But the dinner that we hosted, one of the dinners we hosted for him, we had Charlize Theron and Sarah Jessica Parker and Robert De Niro, to name a few, and plus all the boring UN types as well. I mean, we had to throw them in, but we used to have so much fun doing the seating for this. You know, Richard and I would be sprawled on our bed with these seating charts, moving names around like a couple of generals planning a battle, because he always had some kind of a scheme in mind. This was not, you know, party time. This was diplomacy in a very nice setting. And we had as our first house guests when we moved into that apartment, President and Mrs. Bush, the elders, 41 as opposed to 43, who'd had the same job and lived in the same apartment. So Richard said, let's invite them as our first house guests. And, you know, Richard was one of these people who really thought that party lines had to be bridged, not walls erected between them. And obviously, I mean, he was a Democrat, Bush Republican, obviously, but men of goodwill and great patriots. And guess what? The Bushes were there the next weekend. And we had a great time, and in those days I was working on my book on presidential marriages, so and I told them, I was very honest about that anything you say might turn up in my book, and so it did. But we had a wonderful time, and I remember one conversation with President Bush, which was so revealing to me, and I cite it in my book on Paris. It was the night before the New Hampshire primary, in which his son George W. was a candidate, and I said, just to kind of, you know, I like to get conversation going, I said, so what if he loses tomorrow? And without pausing, President Bush said, oh, Jeb would make a very fine candidate. And I thought, whoa, that explains so much about Bush family dynamics and you know, the psychodrama that we then lived through for 8 years of, you know, the W trying to get his father's approval when it was so clear that Jeb was the favored son.
Yeah, that was quite an answer. Isn't it? I love the fact that you know Mandela, because there is some of these themes, and you certainly have seen this in your life, of this great arc of history and some of Michelle Obama's comments last night of, you think of that Sam Cooke change is going to come and how it doesn't come in grandparents' generation or maybe our generation, but there's going to be change. And you have seen, you're not, your life isn't real long yet, but you have lived long enough, and certainly your husband's, and particularly Richard, were able to see substantial change.
Oh, yes.
Sometimes it takes a long time to come, and certainly you must have felt that with Mandela and with the whole arc of your life, in a way, haven't you?
Yes, definitely. I'm not 100 years old yet, because, you know, sometimes when I hear people talking about, you know, all the things that I've lived through, good and bad, I feel like, holy cow.
You've packed it in.
Yeah, you've really packed it in. Yeah, the Cold War, and which was my early childhood, and of course, the Holocaust through my grandparents, which came as a shock, that discovery. And then, as a journalist myself, covering some pretty astonishing events, terrorism in Ireland and even I covered terrorism in Europe too, the Red Brigades and other such, but I also covered Khomeini, the Ayatollah Khomeini, as he was planning on turning Iran into an Islamic Republic. I covered him in exile, which was an astonishing. I write about that as well. So I packed in a lot before I became a mom and an author. So I think that Richard was able to benefit from those experiences too, and he, neither of us made any bones about sharing each other's skills when I was head of the Committee to Protect Journalists, a non-governmental organization that I headed up for and that I still work with. He would let me interrupt meetings, and I write about this, when we were touring in Africa when he was UN ambassador. And while he would meet with, as I say in the book, while he would meet with the torturers, I would meet with the tortured. And I sometimes burst in on his meeting with the torturers, bringing the tortured. And, you know, a lot of other husbands in powerful positions would have been a little put off by that, but not Richard. So we really were a good couple, I would say. I mean, like all couples who have a long sustained marriage, not perfect. But and again, I'm honest about that as well. You know, I don't want to paint an unrealistic portrait of the perfection of our union, because there ain't no such thing. Only in gauzy romances does that happen. But we were real partners in pretty much everything we did. And shortly before his death, we were picked as one of five great couples by the Asia Society and New York Institution. And I remember saying in my acceptance of that honor that I have no idea how I'd get anything done without Richard's support.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here I am, and I am getting things done. But
you still have his support.
I think
even
I do.
Even though he's not here, you still have his support.
Yeah.
You got to tell the story. I love stories. I always ask people how they met each other. And this is one of the best stories I've ever heard of how he
turned up in Paris.
How he turned up in Paris. It's in the car he was driving. And you got to tell that story before we go back to phone calls.
Okay. Well, you have to tell me if I'm taking too long. Well, this was 15 years after my marriage to Peter. I left him with our two little kids because I was unhappy, and landed on my sister's doorstep in Paris. My sister had the good sense to marry a Frenchman, and Peter followed. This was Christmas of 1993. Peter followed, wanting to give one more try, and I knew that I loved him, but I couldn't stay with him. So Christmas Day, I checked into a hotel, which, I mean, it's a miserable thing to do, leaving my kids with
yes,
my sister
yes.
and Peter. And Richard, who was in those days the American ambassador to Germany, had some kind of a GPS on me but not in any stalky way. Just he seemed to always know where I was, and he tracked down my sister's telephone number and called and found out, you know, that I was finally leaving. And so he drove his own armored car, the ambassador's armored, huge, like a tank car, and from Bonn to Paris, and rescued me, but not in any romantic way, I didn't think, just as a friend doing a good turn. And because I was a mess, I couldn't stop crying. I thought my life was over. You know, here I'd just left my kids, my husband, and nobody in my family was sympathetic. They thought I was crazy. And Richard said, "Come on, jump in. What's your favorite part of France?" And I said, "The Loire Valley." So we took off in the gray December drizzle, and for 5 days we toured the chateau of the Loire, and with me crying through most of it, really lousy company. And Richard just didn't seem to mind. He kept telling me all these great stories of you know, bloody chapters of French history, and he knew everything about French Romanesque architecture, and you know, every night we stopped in a different hotel, always two rooms, that he had picked. And so he was, and at the end of 5 days, we drove back to Paris, and he, I don't want to give everything away. But
you don't have to.
Yeah.
It's just
and
that, what a story
it was the start.
Is.
It was the start of a wonderful 17 years. And what really blew me away was that he had a memory of a decade of sightings of me in New York. He was convinced that we were meant to be, and he was willing to wait it out.
Isn't that a story, Connie?
Yeah.
I mean, for all that time, he did have his GPS on you before there was a GPS.
I'm not saying that he was living in a monastery for 10 years waiting for me to
He was with
Diane Sawyer.
Diane Sawyer at that time.
Right, for 7 of those years, yeah.
All right, let's pause for a moment. And let me invite the audience again. This may be the kind of interview you want to listen to, but feel free to join us if you would like. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Connie Martin is our guest. Her book, a memoir, is Paris, a Love Story. She was married to both Peter Jennings and later to Richard Holbrooke, who died, it seems like yesterday. It's been how long now? It's been
a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah,
now.
Not that long.
No.
Doesn't seem long at all.
And she's had this very rich life, too, of growing up in Hungary and what happened to her parents. And the book is, as she says, a very honest portrayal of her life and the great happiness and the world around her and the stories that she covered as well, her children. And it's a very honest portrayal of a fascinating life with people who are front and center. So join us if you want. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder that Connie will be speaking tonight at Boswell Books on Downer Avenue. That's in Milwaukee. It's a great bookstore. And she'll be speaking at 7 o'clock tonight. So those of you in this greater area of Milwaukee will probably want to attend. I want to talk a little bit more about living about death being with you. It would seem to me a good portion of the time that you were married to both of these men, and also it was something you were covering, troubles in Northern Ireland and turmoil in the Middle East, so it was something that you were covering as well. Were you living on the edge a lot when Richard was in these war-torn places and when Peter was also going to the Middle East with the Ayatollah? It seemed as though it was omnipresent in a way.
I suppose my whole life I've been living less than a placid, peaceful life.
Yes.
I mean, I'm the one who opened the door to the secret police agents who came for my mother, who were masquerading as electricians.
You opened the door for them. You didn't know. Oh, Cotty.
Yeah. Mm. And, you know, just called out, Mama, and then went back to my room where I had a playmate waiting, and then I didn't see her for a year.
Mm.
So I guess I have built up both... I'm going to do a shrink job on myself here. Both a need for adventure, because it's clear that that I'm not about to settle down to a peaceful life now either, and but also resilience to the storms, the unexpected storms that life hands all of us, and I think I have good. What's the word? Bounce back capacity, but that doesn't mean that that I don't carry the losses with me. But I think that I try to convert the losses into something positive, and I do, you know. You might think this is weird, but I consider myself extremely fortunate as a person. I mean, I started off in life with a pretty bad hand, and you know, as a little kid in Budapest, whose parents were enemies of the state, officially pronounced that because they were very pro-American, and they were both journalists working for American wire services. My father was the AP correspondent, my mother UPI. Well, I mean, right there you got the makings of a less than placid household, two competing wire service reporters for parents,
right?
Who then one day go off to prison,
right?
And leave my sister and me with no one, because the communists had planned this for a long time and gave our grandparents, who were living with us until shortly before my parents' arrest, they gave them their emigration. Papers to go to Australia to make sure that these two little kids, my sister and me, were left without anybody. Because that was one way that they could break my parents, was they withheld all information about us. Now, I'm a mother myself, and when I think about not knowing what's happened to my kids, I would just freak.
Yes. Well, and as long as you're talking about your children, are they launched? Are they happy?
Yeah, they're great kids. Peter would be very proud of them. You know, I feel pretty bad on the father score because they've lost two fathers. I mean, Peter and then Richard. Richard was a very hands-on stepdad to my kids.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter Elizabeth Jennings is in the humanitarian field. She's been living and working in Haiti for the World Food Program, and now she's back in New York at headquarters in New York, awaiting what will inevitably be another crisis zone. And she was very much influenced by Richard in her career choice. My son, I'm happy to say, seems a little more influenced by Mom. He's writing his first book in Brooklyn, and a subject completely unrelated to anything I've ever done, and I'm sure will be much superior to anything I've ever done, a book about American history.
Well, you tell him we want to interview him down
Thank
the road.
Thank you.
We'd like
that
very much to do that. I need to talk to you because we're in the middle of the DNC, and I know you've written a book on First Ladies as well. Mm. To talk for just a moment about you have not had a chance to interview Michelle Obama, but I would imagine that you would soon. But from what you've seen about her, the way she's navigating her role, and also it's a huge historic role for her too. You know, when I was watching her last night, I keep thinking I'm moving past the narrative, but I'm still astounded that African Americans are in the White House right now, and all that it took for her to be there last night. I keep thinking about all of that.
Yes, it's remarkable.
Yeah. So is this a remarkable thing to have an African American first lady?
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. I mean, weren't we all tremendously proud 4 years ago that our country could overcome its past and elect this man? Without wading into political waters, I I want to say that I think she's been a really positive role model and has basically done an exquisite job in very brutal times, I would say. We are no longer living in a time when a first lady can really do substantive things without getting in real trouble, because it's too contentious an environment. And you know, the longest chapters in Hidden Power are about Eleanor Roosevelt, Nancy Reagan, and Hillary Clinton, for the simple reason that those three ladies were so powerful, but in a substantive way. I mean, Jackie Kennedy also was much more substantive, serious than she's given credit for.
Yes.
She was way more than a fashion plate. She basically crafted the image of her husband's administration. She came up with Camelot and turned the White House into a stage for the world, the best and the brightest in the world. And of course, Nancy Reagan was her husband's chief of staff. She was the one who did the firing, which her husband was incapable of doing. And mm-hmm. we don't even have to go to Hillary, because we, you know, those two were full partners from the get-go. So Michelle is nowhere near that in terms of her power, but what she has done is she's been a very positive role model. I think undertaking obesity as an issue is very important as I travel the country, very important. Basically, being hugger in chief is about all that she can do without getting in trouble.
Kati, thank you so much. I've just loved meeting you. Thanks. Kati Martin, the book is Paris, A Love Story. Again, for those of you who would like to meet her in person, she's tonight at Boswell Books on Donner Avenue at 7 o'clock. What a life she has led. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Until tomorrow.